Welcome, everyone. Sorry we're a little late, but welcome, everyone, to the Space Game Junkie Podcast. I, as always, am your co-host, Brian, and joining me, as always, is your co-host, Jim.
Thinner Jake.
I don't know
what
that means.
Who's your favorite? What?
What?
You have no idea what that means?
I don't know what that means.
All right, well, gotta go. Can't hang out with you anymore.
Stop it. Okay. We have a guest this morning. Well, it's morning for me. It's afternoon for him. Joining us all the way from Sweden, Paradox producer Joe Fricano. Hello, Joe.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, thank you for coming. This is very exciting because we are talking Ancient Space, the first game from Creative Forge Games. And they just went live. This game just went live like moments before we started this stream. Like, you can now buy this on like Steam, like right now.
Yep. Steam and a lot of other places. It just went live just a couple of minutes ago. So,
well, congratulations on that.
Everyone here is like all excited and stuff. And
well, you should be, because you guys were nice enough to send me a key yesterday, so I got to try some of it last night, and it's interesting. It's fun. It's challenging. We'll take a look at that.
It was meant to be. I know they're popping a lot of champagne at Creative Forge right now, because it's been really hard. Because I'm sure you've noticed, a lot of people noticed that we sort of did kind of a different marketing thing on this game, and that we kept it under wraps.
Yeah.
Until it was very nearly ready to go, instead of like releasing stuff really early and hyping with pre-alpha stuff and everything, we just sat on everything until it was all really looking good.
I was gonna say, you guys couldn't have timed that better with the whole Double Fine nonsense and everything that shows some of the perils of early access. You guys did pretty much the exact opposite tack.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I haven't really followed the whole Double Fine thing, but I've been a fan of their games for a while, and I don't know what the latest controversy is really, but generally the game development is such an imprecise science that it's really hard to like give super solid promises all the time, and you sort of when you sit by the sidelines and see stuff happen, you can sort of understand, okay, things went wrong here and there or whatever, but I mean, it's easy to overpromise sometimes, and it's easy to expect maybe more than what might be reasonable or whatever, but it's games. I mean, it's a crazy fun industry, and that's why we do it. So,
oh yeah, and no, it's great, because one, I got to appreciate the fact that you guys didn't have this. I mean, I do love the early access thing. I love seeing how the sausage is made, but there are some pitfalls to that, and I can totally see the appeal these days, especially of waiting to have it right before a game is going to come out and keeping it under wraps. So it's easier to play the expectation game. Like, oh, we're almost done. This is what we have. This is what we're doing.
On the other hand, I mean, it's not like, I mean, we didn't just like develop the game completely blind and then, oh, I hope everybody's going to like this. I mean, obviously, sure, we did a lot of testing behind the scenes, and we showed the game off to select groups of friends and people and so forth, and did a lot of testing behind the scenes. It's just that we didn't want to go out to the like general mass until we knew what we were going to show. And I mean, yeah. I mean, there have been a few instances where in the last few years where games have sort of overpromised and overhyped a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And gamers being disappointed here and there, and since it became evident when we signed this game really early that this game was going to have really high production values, graphics, audio, and so forth, that was another thing that was okay. We have to be a little bit careful here, that because when we go out and start showing this game to people. Because I mean, the guys at Creative Forge, They are fantastic. And you, it's like I've talked about this before in our streams, but the amount of work and craft that they put into each level, it's like insane.
Yeah.
So we sort of knew that, okay, when we show this off, we want to be able to say that, okay, the first trailer we release, this is in-game graphics. This is the game, and there's no shenanigans or no enhancements going on. This is the actual game captured while somebody was playing the game and positioning the camera and so forth. So we wanted to try something different in that respect. And I see you're loading the tutorial now, and just. I've said this before as well. Just the fact that they lavished so much attention on making the tutorial look beautiful.
Yeah, it's stunning.
It impressed the hell out of me. It was just that they would go to that extreme.
So how large is the team that's working on this thing?
It's been a little varied, I think. I think they've averaged maybe around 20-ish.
Okay, does that include the artists, or is this one of them?
Yeah,
okay.
That's the whole thing. I think they've probably gone from like between maybe 15 and 25 and so forth. And that's not like not counting testers and such. But I mean that's the core team basically. Mm-hmm. And then of course we have some external people. I mean, we have a couple producers here at Paradox, of course, and then the external writer and so forth. But the core team of the game is around 20, 25, something like that.
Oh, okay. Because I thought it took at least 100 people to make a game that was this AAA. So.
Well, I mean, it's not. It didn't take 2 months to develop it. So, and of course, I mean, it was also the reason. One of the things why, because I mean, we've had a few comments on why did we choose to go single player only? And it's well, okay, when you start out with a project like this, that's not a $50 million budget or $100 million budget. You sort of have to choose. Okay, we can do this with this much money and time and these many people, and which, okay, do we do an expansive game and cut down on all the graphics and stuff and do multiplayer and single player, or do we, because I mean multiplayer is, I mean, Paradox, at Paradox we love multiplayer as well, but multiplayer demands such focus and attention that instead of spreading out the resources, we wanted to concentrate on something. And looking at what space games are currently available, there are still quite a few multiplayer focused titles, but very few really hardcore single player with a very well constructed story. So we thought, well, let's go that direction instead. I mean, sure, we'll lose a few people that really want the multiplayer, but on the other hand, the single player crowd have received very little love over the last few years, because I mean, it takes a lot of very specific resources to put a single player experience together if you're going to do the whole thing with the voice actors and so forth and get all that like really to a level of polish.
Yeah, and I gotta say I particularly appreciate that you guys made a single player game, because I'm all about single player. So when I read that this was solely a single player game, I got a little giddy, because I'm tired of like multiplayer feels tacked on in a lot of games and it feels half-assed. Because people want it so badly, they're like, fine, well, just throw in some multiplayer and we'll sacrifice single player a little bit. And
exactly.
I get really tired of that. Tired of that.
And you don't want to, and that was sort of the reasoning here. Well, we sure tack on multiplayer, but no, let's focus on the single player and make 100% sure that we can get that right and get everything really, because I mean you can do a so-so multiplayer, or you can get like the last kind of edge of polish to the single player experience. And we sort of went for the latter, just to instead of spreading out the resources, we focused everything on the single player. I mean, that's I'm personally a single player fanatic myself, so it was an easy choice for me personally. But I mean, ultimately, that's what it came down to.
Yeah, but when I found out that it was going to be single player only, it was like I felt a disturbance in the force, almost like millions of Korean StarCraft players cried out in agony. So, you know, because an RTS without multiplayer, unheard of.
True.
How can it be?
On the other hand, it's not the gameplay isn't, I wouldn't say that it's at all geared towards a competitive style. This is much more like a I don't know how to describe. This is
it's much more story driven kind of thing.
It's slow. It's a little slow paced. Well, not slow paced. There's a lot of action going on in the battles, of course, but it's a little bit more methodical. You sit back in your easy chair and pause and take a look around, because I mean it's the it's not a frantic click fest or anything, and there's it's more akin to like if we go back like maybe 15 or 20 years, I know you've played like a lot of games like Starflight and such, as I did as well during the 80s.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Like the feeling you got when you played those games, even those were like completely different types of games, but the sort of the feeling of exploration that a lot of old school space games would give you, this sort of sometimes has the same type of feel, even though it's a modern game RTS with all the modern graphics and such, but like the feeling of being on this kind of journey instead of having like a little bit more of a back and forth match kind of thing, which is what most like esports type of games aim for.
It's a more crafted, more sculpted experience.
Exactly. And that shines. And that's another thing as well, that if you do multiplayer, then you generally want to be able to offer lots and lots and lots of maps and have a map editor and things like that. And that means you have to make most of your content a little bit more modular and generic instead of, as Creative Forge have done here, and what they've essentially sculpted each map individually. Very little graphics have been reused beyond like the general ships and base installations and such. But I mean, in the way of background graphics, very little has been reused from mission to mission. So each mission looks like a separate oil painting in itself.
It really does. And it's stunning. Now, one thing I wanted to ask you about the gameplay is I'm in the tutorial here.
Yeah.
And we have different sectors going to different parts of the tutorial. I haven't gotten far in the game itself yet, but that's going to be part of the actual game too, is different sectors.
Yes.
In one mission?
Yes.
I love that kind of stuff. Did you ever play Conquest Frontier Wars? It did something very similar a long time ago.
No, I can't say as I remember it. It's somewhat familiar, but
it's an amazing RTS, as I'm sure this will be, because I'm really enjoying it. And it's just gorgeous, and I like the controls, you know. I like the WASD. I like the use of that.
Yeah, and don't forget the Q and E that will take
down. Oh,
yeah. And it's kind of funny because one question we keep getting, and no matter how many times we explain it and tell people, people say that it doesn't look like it's in 3D, or they ask us, is this in true 3D or is everything on a 2D plane? And everything is in 3D. You can send your ships off straight up or straight down if you want. But when you play an RTS like this, you sort of tend to play from the angle that gives you the best vantage point, and that is almost always a top down sort of isometric. So that makes people think that it's everything is on a 2D plane, like a lot of space games are, when it in fact it isn't.
And you do have that option with this tactical view here. When you hit tab, you get this this kind of zoomed out, iconic view that gives you a much wider feel of the battlefield. And yet you can still pause from here, which I love how you guys have a tactical pause. For me, that's super important in games like this. And so I love that you have a pause where you can just still give orders and stuff. But yeah, from here, Sorry, go ahead.
What you can also do is the thing was that the pause, we were talking about it for a long time, and we had a lot of feedback early and said, oh, it would be really good if we had a pause, and but it's an RTS, but RTS games, should they really have a pause function? And well, okay. Like the lead programmer, who's really good at Creative Forge, he was like, well, it's not going to take long to implement. So they implemented it, and it was like, hey, wow, everybody loved it. So it stayed. And what you can also do is if you're in the pause, function, you can click around and not only give orders, but you can go around looking at what your enemies are doing. So you can click on an enemy while paused and see what the enemy is up to, if he's attacking something or just moving somewhere or whatever. So that sort of gives you a big...
I'll say that's a feature that I really enjoy knowing is there. Because, the thing of it being a single-player-focused product instead of trying to incorporate multiplayer, because you can't... In a multiplayer thing, there's no way you can pause and give orders, right? And
no.
for the people out there who aren't real twitchy at controlling a whole bunch of stuff, and you're not a hotkey piano player, you know. So
exactly.
So that's good for us old people, and that's good.
I count myself as one. So
exactly, those reflexes aren't what they used to be.
Absolutely. No. So this is actually the development team's first game under this banner. I know you guys have to have made something before, because this is not a first game.
I think that the team is generally a mix of veterans and a few little younger newcomers, but I mean, a lot of them have previous experience. I know a couple of them worked on like the Call of Juarez series and stuff like that. So this is their first strategy game, though, which is one of the things sort of when we signed the game at Paradox, we sort of brought a little bit of our sort of strategy expertise, if you want to call it that,
right?
To just sort of guiding the game along and how to streamline certain things and how to focus on certain others and so forth.
Yeah. Hey, so since you can talk to the people at Paradox for us, there's a request I want to make. It's only four words: Crusader Kings in Space. You don't even have to call it Dune, but we'll know what it is. And just, you know,
Crusader Kings in Space. Okay, I promise you, I will pass it on.
You know, maybe if there was some sort of spice in it, you know, maybe some worms. But we don't have to call it Dune. It could just be Crusader Kings in Space.
Yeah, Bob. That I probably wouldn't mind playing that myself. I will pass it on, I promise. I think the world needs more space games in general.
Oh, God, yes. Oh,
you've come to the right place, sir, because...
Yep.
Yes, you have. Wait a minute.
This is pretty neat looking. The interface is really clean. There's not a lot of confusion. It's like I can look at the screen there, and having not seen this before, I can pretty much tell what everything does. You know, so that's pretty good.
We went through, I think probably three or four different iterations of the interface before we were all happy with it. Just in general, cleaning things up, moving things around, redesigning buttons.
It's good. I mean, whoever's on the UI team, you know, give them a hug for me, because it looks nice.
I will. So, they'll be very happy to hear that.
So the one thing I'm kind of wondering about here, though, because you said, you know, it's fully 3D, and but whenever you have units that are off the Z plane, you know, they're like above and below the center line.
Yeah.
How do you actually track visually where they are? Because like a lot of games will have like an altitude pole or something like that that shows where in the XY coordinates they really are, because when something is above or below the plane, then it's kind of hard to line up above them without some sort of a reference to the actual coordinate that they're at.
if
because I just run into that in other games. There's I won't name.
Yep.
I won't name the game, but I yelled at the guy for 6 months. Like, good God, put altitude poles in. So
we actually did have altitude poles as a standard before. But we sort of came to the conclusion that they were a little bit too cumbersome to have. But if you go into the options screen, if you go into options, I'm in the game separately here now, so I'm not steering you wrong here. If you go into the general section, the options, press F10. We have the options on F10 and not escape.
Got it.
And there's a point called display unit guides.
Oh.
And if you activate that, then there you go. Altitude lines.
Oh, yeah, there you go, Jim.
There it is. All right, sold.
Generally, we kind of felt that, well, a lot of us playing prefer to play with them off because the screen becomes a little bit more cluttered when you have lots and lots and lots of ships there.
I can understand, you know, for visual aesthetics, you know, toggle it on off or something.
So and we find that, I mean, most of the time when we play, we don't really find them that essential. So, I mean, we usually keep them off, but if you want them, they're there. So,
okay, that's awesome. So 10 of 10, would poll again. So
here's a, I'm looking at you playing here. There's also, you're coming up on another slightly unusual mechanic for an RTS, and that is that we have a slightly different kind of line of sight system, and that we rely on. It's a little bit kind of reminiscent of something like in Star Trek, where you will have sensors most of the time and stuff. Because I mean, we have some ships in the game have cloaking devices. And some areas in the game have like cloaking fields, so you can only see them if you actually break the border and get into them. So it's like you have to sometimes plan for the unexpected. And the area you just entered now, you saw before, it had a big sort of grayed out eye over it. That meant that it was cloaked. So it encourages you to explore a lot more, and you can't just always sort of hang back and wait for the battle to come to you. You have to be a little bit proactive and go out and seek out the enemy and find out what is going on.
Which is nice. I like that. It forces you to be like active and stuff. So that's awesome.
It goes back to the whole thing. The thing we were talking about a little bit earlier, I think even before we even started the cast, when we were talking about how if you fail a mission, it's because you weren't paying attention, or it was because you weren't doing your job properly. And it sort of goes back to that the game rewards you for keeping on your toes and for not, I mean, when you need to rest, there's the pause function, but you don't just want to. It was kind of funny because the lead designer, his name is Casper. Hello, Casper, if you're listening. We were talking a couple of weeks ago about some, not a couple of weeks ago, this was further back. We were discussing some feature, something having to do with the automated unit behavior. And we were discussing, well, should we have the units do this automatically or not? And he was just like, well, did you want the game to play itself for you? he had a really good point there. So, I mean, that.
Yeah, no, the units seem to do what they should do in an RTS. Like, if an enemy gets near them, you shoot at them. I mean, that makes sense. But, like, they're not going to go off and do their own crap if you don't tell them to.
They have some inherent unit behaviors in that a unit, if they're attacked, they will return fire and Under some circumstances, they will pursue a little bit, but they're not going to go off and do crazy stuff without you telling them to. So, they're not just going to stand there and die for the most part. But unless you order them to, finding that sort of balance between how much micromanagement is acceptable.
So how much audio feedback do you get from the units? Because I was watching a video last night where one of you guys was getting interviewed, and they were talking about how many voice actors were involved and that. So one of the things that Brian and I are very, very fond of in Homeworld is the whole background chatter that goes on that sounds pretty plausible as far as like radio chatter between spaceships. And then when things come under attack, you know, they're like, hey, I'm getting attacked over here kind of thing. So
what we did was we wanted to have a situation where we didn't want the general ships, the smaller units and such, to have a lot of spoken audio feedback, because I don't know how many games, special strategy games, you've played that where you hear the same yes sir, right away sir, acknowledged. Even if you do 10 variations of the exact same thing, you're at the end of it all, you're gonna hear it so much that you're gonna be sick. So we wanted to tone that down. But on the other hand, we have our sort of mission control computer, his name is Hector, voiced by the wonderful, absolutely wonderful, my childhood hero, Dwight Schultz. He actually plays I think it's three characters in the game. His voice is so fantastic. He can make his voice do anything. So you can ask him to play 1,000 characters. He could carry a game by himself if you paid him to. So he does the voice of Hector, the ship's computer, and Hector will tell you, like, when you have mission critical craft under attack or being damaged, like your carrier ships, when then you will get a spoken audio cue. But a lot of the time, like just when you're giving general mission orders and stuff, you're not going to get an acknowledgement, like spoken order. In those cases, we just decided to have like regular interface, like blips and sounds for those kind of things. As far as background chatter goes, what we did was one of the things we decided really early was, okay, this is it's a game about spaceships blowing up other spaceships. It's not about the characters. The characters in the game are essentially the spaceships, kind of. So even though we're going to have humans controlling the ships and have intrigue and plot and everything, we have to have – this is not going to be a personal dramatic story full of anguish and torture for one individual. It's not about that, because – you're going to see the main characters, the human characters in the game, you're going to see them as little portraits in the game. And there are so many games out there that try to force emotion on the players. And a personal pet peeve of mine is I absolutely hate it when a game becomes overly dramatic or tries to point out to you. It's almost like a lot of games tell you, hey, this is really sad, you have to listen to this, or this is really dramatic, this is important. And we wanted to go in a completely different direction. So what happened was we were listening a lot to NASA broadcasts. And if you listen to a typical NASA broadcast, like when they used to do the shuttle missions and stuff, you will hear the everyone at mission control and on the shuttle and on the space station, they will always speak in an even tone. No matter how dire the circumstances, I mean, even during the horrible Challenger and Columbia incidents, when you listen to the chatter going on, the instructions going back and forth between various mission control operators and such, everyone keeps an even tone, even though the situation is horrible and they know things are really bad. Everything is always – they almost sound bored. And this is something that games generally don't do. They will have voice actors that like over-dramatize and yell into the microphone and try to be all hot-headed and stuff. And we said, no, let's not do that. Let's have the plot and intrigue, but let's have the actors just relay information. Even if they're relaying personal opinion, they're just relaying information because they're on a NASA mission, sort of.
Well, so, which is nice, because that means I don't have to listen to blood-curdling death screams from my units. And
exactly. But that's the stuff we wanted to have. No blood-curdling death screams. No drawn-out, oh, no, this is so horrible kind of things. All of that, just all the dialogue was relaying information and just mission specifics. And sure, we have the plot details and stuff in there that you get to follow. And there are twists and intrigue, of course, or it would be really boring. But still, we didn't want it to be intrusive. So if you want to ignore the story, you can just ignore it and have it be background chatter. The dialogue sort of works both ways.
Well, I like that.
Sorry.
Yeah, I like that that's happening because a lot of games, follow Chris Roberts's model, you know, of the Wing Commander dialogue, which is really borderline tolerable, and yeah. You know,
I grew up on the Wing Commander games, so I love them, but it's still the Wing Commander that was a different time in gaming history, I would say. What I'm sort of a little bit concerned about is that in modern gaming, we have games with AAA budgets and really good expensive actors that don't. And I'm not going to give any examples here because that would be mean. But I mean that don't have. They don't use their actors to the full potential. I mean, having one thing, just having your actors, because a voice actor that you set a voice actor in front of a microphone and give them a sheet of paper, here, read this. Their natural inclination is going to be to push it, to do too much. Right. So you want them to tone back, to hold them back, and then occasionally you let them slip a little bit and give you a little bit of extra emphasis or extra color on the really important situations. But I mean, we had NASA broadcasts in the studio, and the actors would listen to them before recording just to get the, okay, we want this. We want you to almost sound bored. You're just relaying information. Even if it's really the situation you're going through is really difficult, the information still has to get across.
Mm. So I did want to point out too, because you said Dwight Schultz does the voice for the computer in it.
Yeah,
and a lot of people might not know right off that's Dwight Schultz that used to be on the A-Team, right?
Yes,
right. And so, Star Trek: The Next Generation, sir.
And Star Trek, he played Lieutenant Barclay in Star Trek
and Voyager. It's true. So I wanted to ask. I want to start the first mission here, so we can hear some of the acting. Who does the voice of the admiral?
That's actually Dwight Schultz as well.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah.
I couldn't tell. I thought
it's a little bit closer to his natural voice, actually. But,
did you ever?
Yeah,
he
plays one. He plays. What we did the thing was is with Dwight that his voice is so great, and he does these crazy things that we have a Russian character in the game called Captain Yuri that you get to meet in Mission 4, I believe. And one of the things we really kind of said also really early was, okay, we want to not do crazy accents too much, because we cast actors that we don't have to have them do lots of different dialects and stuff. They do their own voice for the most part, except with someone like Dwight, who can – he's been doing it for so long, he can twist his voice into just about everything. And he initially gave us this Russian accent. We were a little bit afraid to go too heavy with like stuff like a Russian accent, But Dwight did such a fantastic Russian that we said, okay, it's maybe just a tad too much for the game in the direction we were going, but it's Dwight and it's fantastic, so let's keep it in there.
Well, it was funny because I've only got to the first mission, but the Admiral's voiceover. Did you ever see Space Above and Beyond? Remember that show?
Yeah, I vaguely. I mean, it's been years, but I saw a few episodes. Yeah.
Remember the head of the Marines, the tough guy, the head of that the unit. He sounds like that guy. I forget his name, but he sounds like the head of the Marines.
I can't remember who that was. It's been years since I saw the show.
Such a good show. So I thought I would start the first mission so you guys can hear it over the stream, and then we'll get into it.
Okay.
So you can hear the voice. So you can hear the voice acting. So there's going to be a slight delay.
I'm thinking if you'd have leveraged it, Dwight Schultz probably could have got you Mr. T. And I just at some point in the game, I just want to like click on a ship and click on the enemy and have my ship go, yeah, fool.
I pity the fool.
I'm gonna pity them fools. Yeah.
I like how you have a hardcore mode here where you won't be able to use pause or stuff. I'm not doing that, but I love how you have that option for people who just are way much better than me.
You know, every time you say tactical pause, I get a vision of a police dog. And that, you know.
Okay.
All right, I'm going to start the thing so you guys can hear, and you guys in the stream can hear the excellent voiceover by apparently Dwight Schultz.
And others. I mean, the thing was, we sat around, we wanted actors that had done, for one, very, very few video games. Besides Dwight has done a lot of games, of course, but almost none of the others have done any video games.
Right.
I think Aaron Douglas has done like one or something, is it starting?
Now, that's just a few lines of dialogue.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm seeing the podcast about 10 seconds late here on my end, so I don't know exactly where you are in the game. I'm still seeing the intro movie, so.
Yeah. We'll wait until you're caught up because I want the stream.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a delay in the Twitch thing. We've been fighting that for years because it makes it tough. Like, if Brian and I were in the same room, we could play something and give a live commentary. And whenever we try to do it over the stream, I have to realize, like, oh, yeah, I'm about 30 seconds behind. So, you know, we have to tell each other what you're going to see.
I'm seeing the press enter to continue now. So.
Okay, good. So now we can talk. So, yeah, that was Dwight Schultz. I had no idea that was Dwight Schultz. And that was just a short reading, but he put so much into it. And the little inflections and the perfect pauses, it made it feel so like this is not a game, this is an actual guy giving a briefing. It just felt real and great.
And again, if this would have been most other games, that reading would have probably been very authoritative, like, okay, let's go and get things done. But that's not This is a very experienced guy who's just gotten his mission order. So I mean, he's basically sitting down and reading through his mission orders and, you know, so it's sort of, again, not pushing the story or the information onto the player, not over demonstrating what is going on, just sort of.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of I don't know if you recall the briefings from Free Space 2, but there you had Robert Loggia.
Loggia, exactly.
And you had Ronnie Cox, you know, doing some stuff, and you had Kurtwood Smith, just these amazing voiceover guys, and you could tell that these were experienced voice actors because you're like, oh yeah, get me in the mission, Admiral, I'm ready, you know.
Well, I think it actually shows their professionalism that they can be restrained like that because they can act at a level that is subdued and still get they get that charge across without having to flail around and
Oh yeah. Well, let's jump into this first mission. I picked the medium difficulty level.
So I wanted to talk about the terrain that's going on here because we had. We covered a game a couple weeks ago, old game, called Star Command Revolution. And one of the things that was super striking about that is that space was not empty at all. I mean, it was a whole lot of rocks and just terrain, right? It was almost like a maze of stuff. And in this game, I'd watched some videos last night, like I said, where I saw like one mission that was taking place in it looked like a cavern. Almost, and of course, it'd have to be a pretty big cave to get all those spaceships in there. But it's a thing where you know space is definitely not empty here, and even in the background, we see like a whole lot of terrain that's going on. But then you were saying about you have what you call black space that's in the center, which I guess is where there's kind of nothing. Is it an open area?
Well,
and
not really. What the entirety of the game takes place in the place called the Black Zone. The Black Zone comes from a military term, according to our writer, whose father was in the Navy, I believe, which has, I think it signifies an area that is cut off from communications and such. And this area of space, I think it was like it's the remnants of two stars that collided like billions of years ago, and it's pretty much chaotic. There are a lot of natural resources there, but it's very dangerous. It's full of very strange anomalies, and space and time and the laws of physics don't really work. That's why there are wormholes everywhere. And that's why humanity has also set up like man-made warp gates to traverse this area safely. There's a lot to be exploited and harvested in the area, but it's really dangerous. And this area is like thousands of broken up planets and debris. And I mean, humanity has been there for a few hundred years and like been mining. So there are leftover mining colonies that are been taken over by scavengers and pirates. And there is an alien presence in the game as well that we've been a little bit secretive about it because another thing we don't want to do is we don't want to explain too much. Again, a lot of games will go too far and they'll show you a red blob on the screen and say, "Hey, look, there's a red blob." And we don't do that. We leave it up to the player that if you're interested in delving into the lore more, there's a lot in the game to read and discover, but you don't have to. And we don't automatically explain things. And one of the things that you have when dealing with aliens is that we don't ever show the physical appearance of the aliens in the game. And we have alien characters, but they don't have voices. It's not like Star Trek with a universal translator that everybody speaks perfect English and everything, and so we keep that part of it mysterious, and it sort of ties into, well, as you said, a lot of space games are empty. Space is empty for the most part, and Creative Forge, they wanted space to be a lot more living. Like this is a place that constantly changes. And that's why, I mean, if you look in the background, you see the vortex swirling, that it's active, and things are moving and rocks are rotating and orbiting and debris is just sort of floating around. And it also it ties a little bit into the story, whereas the things are happening in this area called the Black Zone, it's begun to expand again for some reason. And that's why this expedition has been sent in to discover what's going on, because it's the expansion of the zone is actually threatening like outer-lying colonies and such. You mentioned before about a mission in a cavern. We actually have, I think it's two missions that are basically indoors. So it's, oh, wow. we have a prison break in mission four. We've shown it in a couple of the podcasts where you're essentially fighting inside a huge planet sized prison complex, cause you're supposed to free a character. And we also have a mission later in the game that is a little bit like it feels a little bit like the scene in Empire Strikes Back when the Millennium Falcon goes into the asteroid.
Ooh.
And it's generally I've never this is like personal stuff here, but I've never been creeped out while playing a strategy game before. This mission is genuinely creepy. I can't say too much about it because it's very spoiler heavy, and it's an important mission. It's like mission 11 or 12 or something like that. But it takes place inside an asteroid, and you're flying around inside an asteroid cavern with twisting tunnels and turns. Yeah. And the mood that the Creative Forge have created there, both with the audio and the visuals, it sort of gives you shivers down your spine when you play it, and it's just it's very slow, and there it's very different between a lot of the other missions because the action isn't as blockbustery. It's a little bit more subdued, and it's really cool.
No, that's neat, and I like that. You know, the writers didn't take the easy out of saying, well, you know, it's us against evil aliens or whatever. It's primarily a human on human thing, and then the aliens are a little spice. So, that's pretty neat. And we had, have you ever read the Lost Fleet books?
No.
Okay, John Hemry, or Jack Campbell, is the guy that wrote those. We had him on the show because we had spent all this time talking about what a realistic space game would be and how you would deal with time dilation and redshift and, you know, just the whole speed of light mechanic and that. And then we had read his books where he does an excellent job of that, which you just don't see in anybody else's books, you know, where it brings some authenticity feeling to it, where it's plausible. And anyway, but one thing that he did in the books that made me think of there is that he does have aliens in his books as well, but you don't see them. And you know, they're a thing that's there, but it's not like, you know, they pop up on the view screen and have a conversation or anything. They're aliens. We have no idea how they operate. So, yeah. And that was kind of neat because it was like book to book. It's dragging you through like, oh, God, I got to keep going until they explain what the heck these things are, you know. So,
yeah. It's we do something a little bit along those lines because, I mean, obviously we had to take some liberty with the gameplay aspects because, I mean, ultimately you will be fighting ship to ship against the aliens later. So obviously we have to have that sort of interaction, but we can't make them completely crazy or weird, but still keeping as much of the mystery as possible. And keeping things unexplained, and that's sort of it's usually I find things like that really interesting. You never explain to the player, the viewer or listener every little detail because I'm fond of saying that the more you know about something, the less interesting it becomes.
Oh, absolutely.
And that sort of that philosophy sort of guides. So you tell the player enough information to let the player complete their task at hand. Okay, these are the mission objectives. This is our current situation. What's going on? And then you continually give like small trickles of things that they can invest in or ignore.
Sorry,
you're getting brutally murdered over there.
Tip: if you obey the hint guides, that will tell you if your ship is going to be ineffective against another ship or not.
Yeah, basically.
So like, the green signifies that you're good to go, and the red signifies you're going to get creamed if you send a ship after it.
Is that based on just size, or is there a little rock, paper, scissors going on?
There's a little rock, paper, scissors, because you have small ships. I mean, what we have is we have four basic ship classes, small, medium, large, and extra large. It sounds like Coca-Cola, but I mean, that's like buying soda at a fast food place. But we broke it down to make it a little bit simpler. And manageable. And then we have buildings as well. And each ship in the game or each unit in the game has a set strength against all of these. So you can see it down to the right as you see where it says damage. You will see how effective this particular ship will be against other ships of different sizes and classes.
Go ahead.
We also factor in speed a little bit. One thing we wanted to do, we didn't want to have a completely strict rock, paper, scissors because that can like easily get boring sometimes. So what we did was we wanted to have just a little bit of an edge, a little bit, not a random edge, but like any battle will have a little bit of randomness to it. A little bit of unexpected chaos or whatever. So we opted to use the speed of a ship to do that. So the speed of your ship, if your ship is moving or stationary, it will affect how that ship fires, if it can, the accuracy of it, or if it can be hit. Now it's not going to be anything like game breaking really, but just like a little subtle kind of thing in there.
Okay, so I'm getting, okay, so I was supposed to protect three cargo ships. One's already down. One's about to go down. I got three little wings of fighters and two wings of anti-frigate invaders. Yep. And so I got five wings of fighters and a frigate coming in. I don't know how I'm going to survive this.
I don't think you are. But I mean, it's hard playing a game like this and having a decent conversation at the same time.
Yeah, it is. It is.
I think maybe it's time that we talked about the save system and where your checkpoints are.
Yeah,
because how does that work? Can you quick save any time, or is it a checkpoint thing?
Yes.
Oh,
yes, you can quick save. We had it was a long discussion back and forth. Do we include the save or not? Yes, no, yes. Well, let's include it, and people don't. I mean, it's always opting for giving people a choice whether they want to save or not. But you can save at any time. The game also auto saves at critical points during a level.
Because nobody will freak out because it's there, but people will freak out if it's not. So
yeah, exactly. I mean, you can make a case for not having a save, saying, "Well, this game sort of demands a little bit more that you just taking away the option to make it easy." But I mean, the game is especially until you really get into it, it's difficult and hardcore enough that the save function is not gonna, you're still not gonna breeze through the game in an afternoon.
I like how when you fail, it says, "Hey, you should do this." I didn't even notice that last time.
Yeah.
But now it's like, "You should intercept the pirates as they exit the portal."
Yeah.
That makes sense, doesn't it? Duh. I'll try that next time. I'm not going to make people watch me do that again.
Yeah.
So how
do you handle construction of units? Because a lot of real-time games, it's kind of, you know, you get what you got. It's a real-time tactical, not a real-time strategy, right? So it's like you've got these units, do the best you can with them. And then there's the full-on real-time strategy where you have, factories all over, and you're cranking out Zergs and rushing over there with them. So how does that work? Because you've got one main ship that's a mothership sort of, and does it produce all the other things, or do you actually?
Yeah, basically. Well, we have three, two in the beginning, and you get a third a little bit later. That I won't get into too much because it's a spoiler. But we have three basic, what we call them, carrier class ships, and the head of the game, or the head of the mission into the Black Zone, is the Ulysses II, and that is also your sort of base of operations. It's our Enterprise, our Serenity, our Millennium Falcon. We felt that the player, and we wanted to have. We wanted this ship to have a very active role in the game, not just being a mobile factory, but something that you can upgrade and something that you can send into battle if you want to. I mean, if you look at like Battlestar Galactica, the Galactica doesn't just sit, hang back, and give the orders; it gets involved. So that's and the level of involvement is up to you. But the Ulysses II also builds all of your ships using basically two resources, which is energy and tritium. And each mission will start with you having a set amount of these, and you can gain more by exploring the various zones in the game where you can find pockets of energy and resources. And you're also dependent on the amount of available crew, which are actually replicants. We've had a lot of questions because the ships in the game are crewed by replicants, which are sort of they're sort of biomechanical humans, but they have absolutely no like soul or personality or anything. So they are biological robots, essentially.
So they don't appreciate the beauty of the laser beams glittering.
A lot of people seem to find it slightly creepy that we have these Blade Runner-esque people crewing the ships, and we're just like treating them as they don't have feelings, and they don't have, so we're not torturing anyone.
Well, there was an interesting game way back in the day, and it was like a BattleTech kind of board game, and I cannot think of the name of it. It was it Mission Force Cyberstorm?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that one. Where they had, it was clones, basically, and your guy would basically start out as like a blob of protoplasm that was barely okay. human, but as they got experience, then they would kind of become more of a formed being, you know. Uh-huh. But it was really like, you know, hey, I'm dropping amoebas in my robots, and then they kind of become human as we play.
Okay.
So yeah, that was kind of neat. And you could melt down clones. You know, if you wanted to recycle somebody, okay. you just melt him down and then pour him back out. And yeah, pretty weird game in retrospect, but it was neat. But anyway, that's what that put me in mind of, was just thinking about the recycling your people back in that.
Yeah. Anyway, getting back to your question about base building, we don't have any like bases as such. You're never going to be stationary in this game. You're always on the move. You're on the move to explore deeper into the Black Zone. You're in a specific any given mission, you will be jumping between sectors, protecting certain warp gates, protecting other ships. You always, if you lose one of your three motherships or carrier ships, the mission is over. They always have to survive. The Ulysses is sort of like a mobile factory that we play a little bit with reality here. Of course, we say, well, I mean, it's a few hundred years in the future. We have nanobots that do the building and such, and ready-made parts. but you will not have an infinite amount of ships during a mission. There will be only so much you can build, and if you're not careful to conserve, then even if you will, you'll be able to replenish your ships later, but by then your enemies will have either taken out all of your other ships, or you will have lost your mission objectives and so forth. So it's not like, okay, I can sacrifice this ship because I'll get a new one in a couple of seconds anyway. But it doesn't really, it's not that easy. It's not that frivolous with ships. So you can rebuild things as you lose them, of course. But it you still have to conserve, because you don't want to like mass select everything and just send it off and hope things are going to work out, because they're not.
So Zerg-rushing is right out.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen people try it, but it rarely results in anything good, because at any given time you will have, again, if you send a ship up against another ship that is very effective, there's a big difference. Ships that are good against other ships or against other specific ship types will be very effective, and vice versa. So you can have, if you send a ship that is not up for the task at hand, then you're just wasting it. It's not going to do you any good, really. For example, like right now, on my screen, I'm seeing you have a Lancer selected, a squad of Lancers, and they're great against other small fighters and medium-sized ships. But if you send them up against a building or a capital ship, they're not going to dent the hull, basically.
Right. And it's easy to see that like you said, when you click something, you know, and you click an enemy, oh, it's red, I'm not going to be able to do much crap against that. Oh, it's green. Yeah. That's effective. That's good. So right now I'm playing a skirmish, of which there are three, and they look pretty varied. This one looks like just a simple – this one's a little more simple. It's just, you know, face an ever-increasing swarm of enemies. And the other two looked a little more interesting. Can you tell me about the other two skirmishes? because there are three in total.
Right? Yeah.
I can go back and look at the menu. But yeah, if you can tell me about it, great.
The idea behind the skirmishes was we wanted, even though we do like the whole sort of single player, we wanted to have, we realized that we needed to have a couple of spaces where you could just jump into the game and not really care about the story, because oftentimes if you jump into a story mission and you're not really familiar with the game, or you're not comfortable enough by playing the game, then you risk missing the story while you're trying to figure out what's going on with the gameplay. So we decided, okay, we'll have a few skirmish maps and set them up basically as sort of challenge maps with different styles of challenge. As you say, one that just gets increasingly harder, and the others that are a little bit more where you're pitting, where you, the enemy has objectives and you have objectives, and you sort of go at it, and I mean, the idea was to get it a little bit of variation in there, especially again to compensate a little bit for not having multiplayer. So
yeah, which is fine. I mean, especially if like these are well constructed and varied enough to offer a challenge that's outside the main campaign. Now, once the campaign is over and you've played some of these skirmish missions, is there plans for maybe more skirmish missions to be released? Or maybe other forms of DLC, like some kind of random map generator or anything like that?
At present, I mean, the nature of how the maps are built makes a random map generator extremely difficult to do.
Right.
We currently don't have any plans for DLC. We've gotten a lot of questions because, I mean, a few of our games have a lot of DLC and a lot of like small expansions and such. We've got a few questions about that for Ancient Space. We don't have any DLC plans presently for Ancient Space. Ancient Space is very old school in a sense that it's one self-contained experience. So there no DLC ship upgrades, no extra weapons to buy or anything. Everything that we built for the game is in the game. Now, obviously, we released the game an hour ago, so we're not really talking about like what happens next. But I mean, obviously, if the game is very popular and people want more, of course, we will talk internally about how can we continue the game through expansions or how do we have the game live on and keep going. So I mean, of course, I would personally love to see a continuation in various forms, but it's not like we don't have a stack of plans sitting waiting ready for it right now. We want to see, because I mean it's a little bit of a different game to the others that are out there. We want to see what players think about it, the reaction, what people like, if there are parts of it people don't like, and then we'll take that and go back and see what else we can come up with.
Right. Well, I gotta say, we have to wrap this up because I gotta get to work.
Sure.
But I gotta say, I'm really liking what I'm seeing. The gameplay feels fluid and fun. And even though I lost that mission, like, again, it felt, like I said earlier, like Spelunky. Like, it's my fault I lost the mission. I had all the tools available to me. I just didn't use them properly. And even the screen, like you said, even said, oh, you should have done this. That was stupid. I'll do that next time.
As you get into the game, you will discover that you'll start to see some patterns on how the enemy behaves, and you'll start to understand more on how the tactics work and stuff like that. So, I mean, it's only natural. Again, playing a game like this and talking, having a conversation at the same time is not easy.
Yeah. Hey, I wanted to, just before we wrap, I want to squeeze two more things in. Yep. So, as you keep units around, because we were talking about, you know, you don't want to just fling your guys at the enemy and let them die. Is there a reward for keeping some guys alive mission to mission? Do you carry them over and they get experience and get better?
You don't carry individual units over. What you do is your carriers, of course, are with you throughout the entire game, and those you upgrade as you go along. Mm. You probably saw it in the intermission screen. You have options on upgrading both your small ships and your carrier ships.
Okay.
We wanted to sort of let you gear the strategy. Some ships during a mission, some of the smaller ships can be upgraded, like mid-mission. You have an upgrade button. You expend a certain amount of resources, and you will get not a super unit, but you will get an enhanced version of that unit. So obviously, those units will be very valuable to keep around for the duration of the mission. But, mm-hmm. but since each mission is a little bit like its own episode of Star Trek, the carryover didn't really fit in with the overall sort of structure that the campaign was done around.
And there's no like research kind of thing, right? Where it's like, oh, I have to build a science base, and then they crank out new upgrades.
Not as
for
such. No.
Okay. So whenever the ships have, do they have individual abilities that you have to select the ship and then trigger a special power?
Absolutely. Most ships in the game have one or more special abilities. If it's like deploying mines or a special missile barrage or a cloak device, or we have one that's really fun to irritate the enemy with. It's also horrible when they do it to you. It's an EMP where you disable ships. Wait till you get into the hard missions and they start disabling you. And just coming up with tactics to stay away from those is really challenging. And we also have another really cool one is we have a boarding feature that a couple of the ships in the game can board an enemy unit and capture it. And right. You can essentially take over the enemy unit.
Oh, way cool!
And that's really cool. I know.
I can't wait to see that.
Yeah, and with knowing that all the ships have individual special powers and stuff, I just want to thank you again for the tactical pause. So
yes. The pause works really well.
Yeah,
I really like that.
All my dudes in Warcraft had all these powers I never used because I couldn't play that finger ballet quick enough. So yeah.
Well, Joe, I want to thank you so much for taking the time out of what hopefully will be a busy launch day. Again, the game just launched.
Yeah, I hope so. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on. This is a joy. It really was.
I hope you guys enjoy the game and keep those space games coming.
Oh, yeah. If developers, indeed, keep the space games coming. I had no idea this was going to be so crazy, but I love it. It's so great. Life is good. I'm going to cut the stream now, so thanks for watching, guys, and this will be up on YouTube and audio soon. Have a good day.
Let's have some music in here, Boiler. Sure thing.
A bit of sunshine down.